Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
We start with some news off the very top. According to reports, Christian McCaffrey and the Carolina Panthers agreed to a four-year extension worth a reported $16 million per year. There it is. It's done. It's that easy. It's that simple. No drama, no franchise tags, no Cabo holdout in August, just an agreement on a Monday in April. And that's an agreement that officially makes him the highest paid back in the league. And as I tweeted last night, the highest paid back in the league, and he is still underpaid. You heard me. I said it. He is still underpaid. Because this is the guy that we're talking about, a different guy.
Jacksonville with four to rush in, and they come hard. Allen pumps once, now goes over the middle. McCaffrey to the 10, the 5, touchdown, Carolina Panthers. McCaffrey hands the ball to a fan.
McCaffrey picks up the first down, has some room, makes a man miss. Christian McCaffrey in the open field. McCaffrey, touchdown. 76 yards for CMC.
Deep handoff up the middle, McCaffrey running free. Unbelievable, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50 across. Midfield. Can someone drag him down? 20 to the 15, the 10, the 5. McCaffrey takes it home.
Thanks to McCaffrey. No, gives it to McCaffrey, who's going to throw.
Got a wide open man, Hurts. Down the numbers. A touchdown.
Whoa. Gets it out of McCaffrey. He's got tons of room to run. Makes a move and gets in the end zone. Christian McCaffrey undresses a handful of Buccaneers for his second touchdown of the day.
I thought I heard Ked. Hey, damn straight, I'm going to celebrate when a running back gets paid. I'm going to party when a running back, any running back, gets his, because they take a beating on a weekly basis. Then they get thrown on the scrap heap the moment they lose even a fraction of a step. So get every cent that you can while you can, dudes. And I know the saying that they're saying something like that as a reason to go for the never paid running backs crowd. And that's a crew that's had a lot of evidence to point to recently. I understand this. You can look at Todd Gurley's deal. You can look at David Johnson's deal. Both of them are on new teams now. Le'Veon Bell's own coach does not like his fat deal. They're not the only ones. Devontae Freeman was released. Melvin Gordon got a smaller deal from Denver than he initially was offered in L.A. Team never pay a back. Points to all of those deals. And then to the running backs who were in the Super Bowl this past year. Guys like Damien Williams, Raheem Mostert. And they're screaming, you do not draft a running back in the first round. You don't pay them much of anything, and you really do not extend them. To which I say, Christian McCaffrey is not just a running back, and Carolina had to make that deal. Carolina had to make this deal. Let me break it down for you. Look at the production first. McCaffrey just had just under 1,000 total yards from scrimmage as a rookie. Then he had more than 1,000 rushing yards and nearly 2,000 yards from scrimmage in his second year. And in fact, he actually went over 2,000 if you include his passing yardage. And then last year, he had nearly 1,400 yards rushing and over 1,000 yards receiving. He broke the record for running back receptions for the second straight year. Not only that, only DeAndre Hopkins and Michael Thomas had more receptions than Christian McCaffrey since 2017. Only those two guys. And he's just the third player in NFL history to go for 1,000 yards rushing and 1,000 yards receiving in the same season. And the other two guys who did that, Roger Craig and Marshall Faulk, and they did it with Joe Montana and Kurt Warner as their quarterbacks. Christian McCaffrey did it with Kyle Allen, Will Greer, and a busted-up Cam Newton. In other words, Christian McCaffrey was not part of their offense. McCaffrey was the offense. Defenses were not scheming to stop Kyle Allen or Will Greer. They were scheming to stop Christian McCaffrey, and they still couldn't do it. And that's the second point. McCaffrey is not just the focal point of the offense. He's now the face of the franchise. Cam Newton's gone. Luke Kuechly is gone. Greg Olsen is gone. This is an organization in a full-blown rebuild. They're fired up about Matt Rhule and what he can do, but nobody is buying Matt Rule jerseys. Now, I'd say they'd buy a Matt Rule smock, but he's already said he's not going to bring them with him to Carolina. So that means the face of the franchise is Christian McCaffrey, and you can do a hell of a lot worse than having him as your cornerstone. In fact, I'm not sure you can do much better. Have you heard Matt Rule talk about this guy?
He really builds to the culture that you want to have within the building. I mean, we want to be a serious football place, you know, we want to be a place that it's all about the game, you know, and I think that's who Christian McCaffrey is.
So that's exactly what he thinks about him. He's going to point to him and say, that's what we're about. That guy right there represents everything that I'm trying to instill in this organization. And the last thing you can afford with a new head coach, especially during a pandemic, is a holdout from your best player. That would have been a brutal way to start things off for a new head coach. But McCaffrey would have been smart to do it. If I were McCaffrey, I would have done that. Because he's never going to have a bigger hammer than he's got right now. He's the face of the team. He's the focal point of the offense. And you have to make sure he's taken care of before you can do anything else. I mean, to play hardball with that guy right now would have been to shoot Rule in the foot before he even got started. But they could have done that. A lot of other teams would have done that. Carolina had two more years left on that rookie deal with him when they exercised the option. They could have franchise tagged him for a couple of more years. And at the rate they use him, with the volume of touches that he gets per game, they could have burned him in 4 years and kicked him right to the curb. So why do the deal right now? Why should they do it right now? Because it's the right thing to do. And because he's earned every last penny that they're giving him and more. And because there's nobody else like him in the league. He is, in fact, an outlier. And here's a detail, too. When you dig in on that contract, here's what you find. It's an extension to the original deal. So when you combine it and you look at it over the course of the entire deal, he's actually averaging $12.5 million for the next 6 years, which is an absolute steal for a guy who does what he does and what he means to that offense and to the entire organization, top to bottom. Now they're going to have 6 years worth of Christian McCaffrey, and the deal will still expire before he turns 30. So all of you never pay it back, guys, should be very happy about that. Remember, he's not even 24 yet. And here is the other reason to make that deal right now. You don't have 4 years of soul-sucking stories about picking up options and franchise tags. Those are always the most tedious stories ever. There's nothing more boring than talking about the franchise tag. It might actually be the single worst topic in all of sports. Mount Rushmores think that franchise tags are boring and tired and lame. I mean, how long have we been talking about Dak Prescott's contract? Like years. And it's still no closer to being done. The fact that we never had to hear about that with McCaffrey is worth millions onto itself. Hell, I'm tempted to kick in a few bucks just as a thank you to Carolina and Christian because now we never have to deal with that. Now we'll never have that conversation about the two of them. So, great job all around. Different breed of cat, different level of back, and worth every penny and worth more. Great deal for him, and the team did the right thing by giving it to him. Even if all of you never pay a back, dudes want to hear it.
Hey, clones, I've got a great new read for you, a tremendous new book. One with a story that takes you on an action-packed wilderness adventure deep into the wilds of Alaska. Today's podcast is sponsored by Stonecross, the adrenaline-fueled new book by Mark Cameron. He is the best-selling author of the latest Tom Clancy, Jack Ryan character novels. In Stonecross, an Alaskan resident with nearly 30 years in law enforcement, Mark Cameron is a master of action and gritty detail, and he brings this explosive authenticity to Stonecross as you follow U.S. Marshal Arliss Cutter on a manhunt through the untamed landscape of the Alaskan bush. Big storms, predatory animals, dark old growth trees and deep frigid waters could prove just as deadly as your target. Stonecross by Mark Cameron is available right now on Amazon.com and everywhere books are sold. Visit markcameronbooks.com for more info. Mark, M-A-R-C, cameronbooks.com. Dennis Dodd. Dennis, first things first, normally at this time, you and I would be talking about the NCAA tournament, which wrapped up recently, and spring football, but obviously that's all changed. How are you doing in the middle of all of this, Dennis?
Yeah, Jim, I'm doing great. Hunkered down with the other Janet. It's just you, her and I at home and getting through. You know, it's just different normal right now.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Dennis Dodd is joining us. Let me start with a piece that you did on Alex Charlton. For those who do not know who that is, who is he and what caught your attention, Dennis, about him?
Alex Charlton has been a lifetime kind of GA fringe guy who, like thousands of other guys, have wanted to break in and become a college coach, assistant coach. He goes back as far as 2009 when he was a student assistant under Mark Mangino at Kansas and actually rose to under Charlie Wise's assistant director, other first salaried employee. But it's so hard to break through. In the interim, he had gotten a nursing degree, and it just caught on last month with Midwestern State as a GA. It's a Division II school in Wichita Falls, Texas. And he'd gotten a call from a nurse staffing agency that said, hey, Mount Sinai in New York needs nurses. Do you want to go? And he said, yes. What people probably don't know is if it wasn't the epicenter of the epicenter, it is now Mount Sinai, which is in the middle of the coronavirus battle. He went there. The first quote in the story is that, I think I'm probably going to get it, but this means too much to me. And I've been in contact with him. He's doing great. But to me, just a hero. Like a lot of people, there's a lot of nurses that have answered the call around the country. This guy to put himself in the crosshairs. I told him at the end of the story,
he's the best man, right? Dennis, let me pick you up right now because our phone line is not that good. You're breaking up a little bit, so I'm going to have Adam Hawk pick you up. That's an amazing story. So Alex Charlton had graduated from nursing school in 2018. He was a graduate assistant at Midwestern State. They needed people like him, and he took that on. We are rejoined right now by Dennis Dodd. Now, Dennis, you were talking about this before the line started to break up a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, the dream, obviously, Dennis, is to be a football coach. What's it say about him that he was willing to put that on hold? Not only put it on hold, but literally risk his life to go to work in New York?
Yeah, he called it, Jim, a vocation. You know, he desperately wants to be a football coach, but he desperately wanted to do this. He waded into New York last Friday or Saturday, and I was texting him. I said, what does it look like? And he said, it's a ghost town, except for Trader Joe's. I was in line with 140 other people, and a gentleman bought me coffee and told me thanks for coming. So it's been tough. I don't know when I broke up, but I told him that this will be the best thing on his resume. He absolutely will get a job out of this. You know, talk about work ethic, talk about putting yourself on the line. This guy is qualified.
What an amazing story. Dennis Dodd joining us. I appreciate your thoughts on that. So, Dennis, roughly a week and a half ago, Dabo Swinney was saying that he expected that the season would start on time and that he had, quote, zero doubt that we were going to be playing and the stands are going to be packed, end quote. Now, look, a week and a half is a long time during a pandemic, and a lot has changed since he said that. Dabo's always been upbeat. He's optimistic. But how realistic do you think that really is?
Yeah, look, I appreciate Dabo's optimism. I'm not going to criticize that at all. But, you know, there's a bunch of benchmarks we need to look at that don't look good. Gene Smith was on a conference call last Friday, the AD at Ohio State, and he put it in perspective. He basically said, we can't have games without fans, and we can't have games without students on campus, because what you're saying is it's not safe for them, but it's safe for the players. And that hit home. There was a Twitter Live conference with a couple of NCAA doctors Friday night, and one of them, Carlos Del Rio, who's the head of global health at Emory University, said, without a vaccine and without special strategies, meaning shelter in place, more intense, that you know, we're not going to have anything by the end of the calendar year. And not many people saw that. And for an NCAA doctor to say that, I thought was profound. It's not looking good right now.
Dennis Dodds, my guest. Something else that same doctor said, Dr. Carlos Del Rio, quote, life is not going to return immediately to normal. It's going to return to something that is normal, but it's not the normal that we used to know. End of quote. What was your reaction when you heard that, and what do you think he means specifically?
I think it's going to be a different experience attending games. I just had a conversation with a Power 5 AD where we just wondered, you know, this is not just coming back, but maybe a period of years where everybody who goes into a venue, not a sporting event, gets shot in the forehead to detect if they have a fever or whatever testing there are at that point. I mean, think of it when you go into an arena and you have your bag checked, or a media member has to go through your backpack. They are going to have to test people if you're going to have that many people come together to make sure there isn't an outbreak. Until we have a workable vaccine that gets to 330 million people in the country.
Makes you wonder, Dennis. For instance, we all would like to return to normal as quickly as possible. We all want this thing to end, but that's just not the way it is. You wonder how long it's going to be. Obviously, if there's a vaccine and you can get it to the people who need it and get it nationally distributed, but you wonder how long is it going to be before people are comfortable going back into an environment where there's 10,000, 15,000, 40,000, 50,000 people? Like, how long is that going to take?
Yeah, there's going to be a psychological scar for a lot of people just going to games, going to concerts, going to any large gathering, you know, looking around, does that person have it? Does that person have it? Even when we're in the all clear. And I should point out the doom and gloom I'm referencing. These ADs and stakeholders, Jim, in the college game are desperate to get a season in to get access to that TV revenue, because they're talking about playing next spring. And if you play next spring, then how much time do you need to get ready for the 2021 season? You would be effectively playing two full seasons within a calendar year with college athletes who can't dictate their working conditions. The NFL at least has collective bargaining. They can agree to go to a neutral site and be tested and shelter and bring their families in. College athletes can't. I keep saying this. If we start in August and one of these players or coaches tests positive, that's a shutdown, because they're quarantined. Everybody they've been in the locker room is quarantined. And all of a sudden, you don't have a football team. If you don't have a football team, there goes your schedule. You don't have a season. So I think it's incredibly, incredibly important for whoever's responsible to get this right.
We're talking to Dennis Dodd. And then without football, of course, there's a great loss of revenue. You mentioned Gene Smith. Dennis, he was saying that the school would lose $5 to $7 million per Saturday if the fans were not allowed there. So when you consider the loss of revenue, as an example, the University of Cincinnati announced this morning that they're ending their men's soccer program effective immediately. Does that feel like a one-off, or could you see more schools eliminating teams during this period?
I think we're going to see a lot more of it. I mean, even if you consider that, you know, maybe it was something that was going to happen anyway and they're using the coronavirus as an excuse, I'm not going to make that judgment. I do know that there was a ripple effect in the college community when the NCAA tournament was canceled. And I don't want to downplay it, but they got 37 cents on the dollar, and even that basketball revenue is just a fraction of what football brings in. So that I don't want to call it a hiccup, but that downturn had a huge effect. I think we're going to see more of this, and if people want to look again for a benchmark, the NCAA will probably in the next coming months, I will estimate, have to get rid of their 14 sport minimum that you need to be in Division I. It's kind of arbitrary anyway, but if schools have to keep cutting teams, and there are a lot on that line, right around that 14 line, I've said this, it could come down to an apocalyptic thing where it's football, basketball, enough women on the other side to balance out Title IX, and that's your athletic department if it gets bad enough.
Dennis Dodd, my guest. Dennis, one last thought. You also pointed out several schools are starting to model and project what it would be like not to have students on campus in the fall of 2020. If there are no students on campus, could you still see sports being played, or is that just not possible?
I can't, but I hear people you know, talk about, you know, maybe, again, the Gene Smith reference where he said, if you can't have students on campus, how can you say it's safe enough for these players to come on campus? And I just talked to an AD who said, well, can we do it if it's grad students only? You know, maybe they're on campus and they're taking online classes, the general population. In general, I think it's a non-starter, but there are people already pushing back to that, pushing back on that notion. If anything, Jim, it's bad optics. You know, then if you're doing that, then the players look like mercenaries. You know, we have to play. And look, I love the game as much as anybody else, but to put them in the way of danger like that, it's a huge. First of all, it's a huge liability, potential liability. I mentioned that one person testing positive, that could be a lawsuit. And again, the pros can collectively bargain their working conditions. In college, they can't, and that would be a liability of a lawsuit.
He is a national college football writer for CBSSports.com, and as I mentioned, a very good friend of the program. He is Dennis Dodd. Dennis, great to have you back. Hang in there, and I know we'll do it again soon.
Jim, stay safe. Thank you.
If you know this show at all, and you followed it at all in recent years, you know I'm not the biggest birthday guy ever. In fact, there are a lot of people that aren't about birthdays, especially once you turn 13. I'm just not one to make a big deal out of my own birthday. Now, there are some people, adults, that love their birthday, and they turn the entire month in which they were born into a birthday celebration for themselves. I'm just not one of those people. So I don't really celebrate my birthday, and I don't really celebrate other people's days of birth as well. I mean, I've got no problem saying the actual words, happy birthday. I'm just not going to rip out the hats and the party horns and really get after it like that. Just not my deal. Some people, though, do, and I respect it. Just not my deal. Some, though, go all in. Some see it as a time of reflection, a celebration of one's life. Like, it is my day. It's only once a year. We're going to make it about me. And we're going to make it about me in the days leading up to my birthday. And we're going to make it about me in the days after my birthday. Again, I'm not really here for that. Hell, even when you clones hit me up every single year on my birthday to wish me your best, of course I appreciate that. I just don't spend a lot of time on it because I want to keep it business as usual. Let's keep moving. Let's do the show. Let's keep grinding. But then things started to change, right? It all changed, in fact, in this past year when I made the decision to add some, how do I put this? Some experience to my staff. Not only did I add experience, I added a celebrated war veteran to the XR4TI. I mean, technically, sure. Ritt insisted he was not one. But you got to admit, he sure as hell has the look of a guy who stormed the beaches of Normandy. And then lo and behold, last October 14th, the old man comes in to wish me a happy birthday. But, and that was fine. Like, thanks, Pops. Thank you very much. Scram. He's like, one more thing. No, I said, no, one more thing. Why are you yelling at me? Oh, sorry about that, boss. One more thing. It's my birthday, too. I'm like, damn, now it's just getting weird. All right. So now Ritt and I have the same birthday. That's weird. But I didn't want to make a deal of the thing because, realistically, how many more birthdays do you think that guy has? So I was cordial and I was pleasant. I mean, sure, it was kind of ironic and more than a small coinky dink. Like, Ritt and I have the same birthday? Although he was born like 15 years earlier, but looks 30 years older, which is strange. But honestly, I mean, not a reason to get on the air and talk about our birthdays together. It's just going to be super awkward. That is until you clones did what you clones do and found out that not only do Ritt and I share the same birthday, but also we share the birthday of the 34th president of the United States, one five-star general, Dwight Ike Eisenhower, to which I say absolute gold. This, I mean, how crazy is this? Not only does Ritt look exactly like Dwight Eisenhower, not only is he older than Dwight Eisenhower would have been, we all share the same birthday. Now it's just getting weird. So, well, I'm not going to lie. I will never be birthday guy on the radio. I don't mind acknowledging a guy when his celebration day is upon us, especially if that guy is old man Ritt and Dwight Eisenhower and me and Thomas Dolby and John Wooden. My guy Stephen A. Smith, too, I think. And a few others that escape me. New year, new me, I guess. Thanks, Ike. Hey, Ike, game on! All right, so the long setup and why I took great pains to say and set that up the way I did, I don't give a damn. I really don't care. Except once in a while, and I hate that, on this day, so-and-so was born. Except on this day, one of my favorite guys was born. So let me take a moment and send my birthday wishes to a certain person who I know rolled out of the rack this morning feeling extremely dangerous. And how do I know that?
I am dangerous.
Because my man wakes up feeling dangerous every single day. And the other 364 days out of the year, one Baker Reagan Mayfield. That's right. If I have the former leader of the free world on my staff, how can I not acknowledge the birth date of the leader of America's team? Baker, my guy, happy 25th. Hey, what, clones? Y'all thought that I was really done with Baker and America's team. Get the hell out of here with that. Did you not just hear me say it's my guy's 25th birthday? 25. What I'm getting at is my guy's young now, and so is his run in C-Town. Not dead, can't quit. And while Baker might be winning the day, even more importantly, the Browns are winning the offseason once again for him. You know, last week I spent all of 1 minute on this topic. Not his birthday. That's new. That's updated. But I spent a minute talking about the Browns, and I mean that legitimately. It was 1 minute. It was a Rome minute. I need more time to lay this out and flush it out. They're winning the offseason again. Have you seen the work done by new GM Andrew Berry? Berry has given Baker another superior target in tight end Austin Hooper. He also shored up the offensive line with the addition of Jack Conklin. He brought in several other nice players on short deals, all while allowing others to overpay some of his own free agents. What I'm saying is, my man's playing chess, y'all. And to quote the great Conor McGregor, Andrew Berry did not come back to Cleveland to take part. He came to take over.
We're not here just to take part. We're here to take over.
And so far he has. Yeah, I know, clones. Great Rome. Outstanding Rome. We have seen this before. Remember last season, Rome? Remember where they finished? Well, I remember. I remember the offseason. I remember the regular season. I remember them ending on 6-10. If you have great weapons, that's fun and all, but it's not like Baker can get the ball to them if he's lying on his back. It's not like he can get the ball to them if nobody in front of him can block. That's fair. You're right. I get that. But I just did mention this is why Berry brought in Conklin, the best right tackle on the market, to a really nice contract. And don't forget, they still have the 10th pick in next week's draft. They still have 4 picks in the top 100 in a draft, which is loaded with left tackles. And hell, I've interviewed several dudes who are plug-and-play guys and a massive upgrade over that drug lord, Greg Robinson. Now, whether my man Greg was stressed out about mapping out his master plan to transport Kron the wrong way across the country or what, I'm not really sure. But I think at this point we can all agree that football really was not his deal. I guess to be fair, neither is drug dealing. Allegedly. Again, anyone is better, let alone a top prospect there. Massive, massive upgrade. Baker is now protected. He actually has a really good chance to reach his massive potential, the potential that made him the first pick in the draft just 2 years ago. My point is, he's just 25. I see all you haters trying to run this guy down, and credit to Baker for taking the criticism. Some of it fair, for sure, and some of it unfair. He has owned a lot of what held him back, and I give him credit for that. And yes, he's got to cut way down on his turnovers, but he will. And let's not forget, this guy can ball. And he's willing to put in the time, and he'll work. I'm telling you, you fix the line in front of him, and this guy's going to be who we thought he was. And if he doesn't know now, he's going to find out quickly that his new head coach, Kevin Stefanski, is going to be very good for him. Look at what that guy did in Minnesota last year. He's going to put Baker in really good situations to succeed and utilize the weapons around him, and America's team will be back. And America's team will be what I said they would be. And just to reset those weapons for all you haters, just in case you forgot, the best collection in the NFL reads like this. Hooper, ODB, Jarvis Landry, Nick Chubb, Kareem Hunt. Find me another team that can match that. There isn't one. So, while technically it is Baker's day of birth, every day right now has got to feel like a birthday for him if and when they ever get back into the facility and they can do the work. But until then, one day at a time. One day at a time for him, one day at a time for all of us. But unlike all of us, today is his birthday. Happy birthday, Baker. And to all you haters, just keep hating. You'll see. When it's time and they get back to work, there will be football at some point. I'm not sure when. I really don't know when, and I'm not looking to rush it back. Let's not bring this thing back before it's time, but there will be football again at some point. And when there is, America's team will emerge. What I'm saying is, when it is time, it is going to be game on. Am I right, Ike? Can I get a game on, Ike? Game freaking on. Happy 25th, Baker. Hey, look, I'll admit when I'm wrong. I don't feel I'm wrong about that. I'm still riding with him. I'm still riding with them. And I'm still riding with C-Town.
Trapper. Trapper, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing great, Jimmy. Hanging tough, off to Medford tomorrow for some more radium serum injections. One doc last week gave me a year, but they don't know Jungle Karma or me. So I heard you mentioning this new phenomenon, Joe Exotic, Joe Isuzu, whatever, and the Netflix Tiger King show, which is killing the ratings. My faith in our jungle continued with you calling this outfit out. I think a bunch of scumbags. I've never watched the show. I got too much on my plate, but I do have some experience with money, guns, lawyers, Kilo Cowboys, and tigers in the high desert up in Victorville. I was a young gun trial lawyer. This is about 30 years ago, Jimmy, in the OC. And in the 80s, I'd won a couple of 187 trials coming out of the gate, got a referral from some MA clients. I'd walked on a bad border search on 200 kilos of blow. And I ended up with this alleged, representing a guy that had an alleged wild animal zoo up in the desert and on a conspiracy to distribute some other stuff. He had 10 tigers and 5 timber wolves he'd mated with Malamute bitches for the puppies. He also had this entourage of 5 guys who lived up there, mostly ex-cons, parole violators, guys who helped care for the animals when they weren't blowing up targets with whatever ordnance or weapons they were packing or shouldering. Very much like I expected the Manson scum to have been, Jim, years before and 40 miles away at Spahn Ranch. Just like Joe Isuzu, again, Joe Exotic, this guy would put on shows on the weekend for families coming up out of L.A. The guy had this twisted belief that these poor beasts loved him just because he fed, slept, and played with them. Same thing with these punk-ass pukes who thought they were bad because they'd done a jolt at the Q, the Bay, Corcoran, or somewhere else on dope cases. My firm belief, Jim, on cons who keep tigers as pets or showpieces, they're total scumbags, to use your characterization. Usually guys with no self-esteem, like the ones who mount trophy heads in their dens to impress their trophy gals on the depleted size of their humanity. As for the hangers-on, like the entourage I ran up with in the San Bernardino Desert, even bigger scumbags who think packing a piece makes you a bad man. As for people like Carol, whatever her name is on the show, you're just a clown, Carol. And that whack your old man and feeding him to a tiger shtick, it's Sweeney Todd all over again. Google that, as I'm pretty sure you couldn't find Broadway with a Sherpa with a GPS up his ass. Yeah, my brother, takes a pandemic plague the size of COVID-19, Jimmy, to get people to watch this kind of defecated detritus. Thank you, Jim, for keeping it real, calling them all for what they are. As for COVID-19, jungle strong. To all my brothers and sisters out there, mask up, honor the 6-foot rule, and we'll all come through this together. God bless, and as always, tramps like us. I'm out.
Tramps like us in Houston. What's up, brother?
Hey, Vance Mack, thanks for the vine. Thanks to Mr. Hawk and the crew. Hey, got two takes, pretty quick, I'll try to make. Hey, losers, clones that let your car sit in your driveway for 3 weeks without driving it, come on. You're not going to have a car in a year if you don't get that thing out once a week. You've got possible bow shaft from your crankshaft to your camshaft to your drive shaft. All that's going to bow if you don't turn it and spin it around. All your gears are going to be dried up. Get it out on the road. At least get it to shift through all the gears one time. It doesn't have to be long around the block or whatever. But get your cars out there. They're not going to be around in a month. They're made to drive. And I see it all over the place. Dust gathering and boll weevils and stuff gathered on these vehicles. So anyway, second take. Great opening on Christian McCaffrey. I think he is dynamic. He is different. He's not just a running back. And just real quick, I was a huge fan of his dad, old Easy Ed McCaffrey, who helped lead the Broncos to a couple Super Bowls. So happy for that. Happy for Christian. He deserves any penny. I'm out.
My man, rack him yet again. We go to Matthew in the City of Angels. Hello, Matthew.
Jaime Roma from the Bada Bing to Brazil. You're welcome. The CBS Sports Net is now on point with the wonderful Jim Rome and all of the clones. Hey, Romy, but the reason why I'm calling is because, man, first, Tony Hawk, what a get, man. That's like my son's favorite skateboarder of all time. Literally just bought the Tony Hawk video game for like the third time again while on quarantine. And now you bring in Christopher Alessanti, a.k.a. Spider, a.k.a. Michael freaking Imperioli. Well played, sir. I'm doing a deep dive myself, going back, watching The Sopranos, one of my favorite freaking series ever on the home box office. Hey, man, ask him who was better, man, to be honest. Was it Gandolfini or was it Ray Liotta as a mobster? I mean, the guy was in two epic settings for the mafia. And, man, Romy, I just got to hear this podcast as soon as possible, man. That's all I got for you, Jim. War Drew and West Los hitting a 900 off of the VA staircase on Santa Monica Bully. War Griffey, the astronaut cat, and Hawk taking their daily catnap under a tree in their gated community. But unwore, Ira Craig using a cardboard mask with shoelace ear flaps. Outro.
He is Allen Robinson. Allen, it's been a minute or two. It's good to have you back. Before we talk about some of the efforts that you and your foundation have done for COVID relief, I want to get your thoughts. How are you and those close to you doing during this really challenging time? How are things?
Things are going well. You know, I'm well, as well as they can be. You know, I mean, in this tough, challenging time, you know, everything is a little bit different. You know, again, I mean, even stepping out the house to get groceries and things like that, you know, you have to take a lot of precautions. But, you know, things are going about as well as they can. You know, I'm still trying to, you know, do my part as far as in the community and also do my part preparing myself for a season. You know, so, I mean, it's a little bit different. But like I said, you know, everything's going just about as well as it could.
Allen Robinson, glad to hear that. This is why I wanted to have you on, because you are one of those people who not only is doing your part to get ready for the season, whenever that is, but you're doing your part to get back as well. You and your foundation typically focus on enhancing educational opportunities for low-income students. But in March, you moved to partner with the Greater Chicago Food Depository to help students who rely on schools for daily meals. How did that relationship come to be, and what's it mean to you to be able to help out in this manner?
Yeah, you know, so for me, like you said, I mean, normally we focus on education, but a big part of, you know, education and for kids, their overall experience at school is that they do get meals. You know, a lot of kids get reduced lunch or get free lunch from the state. You know, so with them not being in school and with them not being able to get that, you know, now that they're at home, some kids' parents and things like that have been laid off. And they don't have the income that they had, you know, steadily over the course of whatever time, you know. So that's just an added burden to everything that's going on. So for us, if we could kind of help, you know, eliminate that for some families and, you know, provide food for families, you know, because, again, I mean, not only is it, is the virus affecting people's overall health, but it's also affecting people's financial situation and affecting it a lot. You know, like I said before, I mean, depending on how many kids parents may have in a household, you know, if you have four kids who are relying on three meals a day for a free lunch, now you have those kids at home and you have to provide food for them. You know, that's big. And on top of you maybe not even still having your job or maybe being laid off and not having the pay that you may have, you know, so it's a lot going on, you know. So for us, we wanted to figure out if we could, you know, help out in any way we could, you know, with also staying a little bit, you know, connected to our overall, you know, agenda is. That's what we came up with. And it's been cool and it's been pretty special to do.
Extremely well done. Good for you. Alan Robinson, my guest. Not only that, but the estimate is a gift of $12 will provide 20 pounds of food for each family. You've already announced that you're going to match the first $12,000. Then your coach, Matt Nagy, said that he would match you. And then you've got teammates like Mitchell Trubisky and some others who announced that they're going to jump in as well. What does all that support from the team and the organization also mean to you?
It means a lot. You know, I think that when you talk about respect and when you talk about things that mean a lot, I think being supported by your peers means everything. You know, for me to be able to even jump this initiative off, you know, to be able to see everybody else kind of, you know, piggyback that, especially, you know, like I said before, my ultimate goal wasn't, you know, for me just to get notoriety about this or whatever. You know, it just was being able to create a platform and be able to create a way for everyone to try to come together and help different families, you know, and I've been able to accomplish that. You know, again, I say all the time, you know, for me, it's not even me just accomplishing it on my own. You know, the only way that I can kind of accomplish, you know, different impacts in the community is by the support of others, you know. So fortunate enough, I've been able to have over the past 2 years support from the Chicago community, support from my teammates and everything like that. And that does mean a lot.
Yeah, frankly, this is nothing new. You did the same thing in Jacksonville as well. Alan Robinson is joining us, and you brought that effort with you to Chicago. Now, from talking to athletes across all sports over the past few weeks, everybody is talking about how they have to get creative to get their workouts in and to stay in shape. So how are you approaching staying in shape?
Yeah, fortunately for me, I have a decent amount of workout equipment in my basement, so I'm able to get a workout there. You know, the biggest thing that I've been creative with is trying to do different conditioning and stuff like that, you know, trying to put up some resistant bands and stuff in the basement to get some running in and looking up different things. Like, this is the first time that I've ever done. It's called like a beep test, and it's like a form of conditioning, you know, that a lot of soccer players use and things like that, you know. So I'm trying to think outside the box and think of some different things I can continue to keep my body in shape for whenever the time comes for us to come back, you know, because I think that's the biggest thing for athletes as well. You know, you can't create a 4 week or 6 week program, you know, because you don't know how many weeks it will or won't be, you know. So I think that's the toughest thing. We're just ultimately trying to continue to stay in as much shape as possible. So when the time comes in and when we get past this coronavirus, you know, I can go to a place, you know, and kind of get more organized training.
We're talking to Bears wide receiver Alan Robinson. Now, you're coming off a year where you were the first Bears wide receiver to break the 1,000-yard mark since 2014. As you look back on the season, what kind of thoughts and memories do you have?
Yeah, you know, that was especially, you know, fun for me. You know, for us, we would have definitely hoped to end the year, you know, in a better way than we did. You know, but for me personally, you know, I think for any receiver, you know, from me in Jacksonville, you know, catching 4,000 yards in 2015, you know, having some rough time in 2016 to tear my ACL, you know, then to come into Chicago and kind of, you know, having to rebuild myself, you know, physically, you know, my first year here, being able to get back to that means a lot. You know, it's probably the most meaningful, you know, accomplishments that I've had in my career, you know, and just kind of knowing how everything has gone, you know, and being able to rebuild myself and my game to get back into rare form, you know. So, I mean, all in all, you know, it didn't, like I said before, it didn't play out how we wanted to be, you know, but I had a lot of fun this season. You know, I'm continuing to try to build on what I did last season, and from a team standpoint, trying to continue to build, build on last year for us and just get back to the playoffs. I think that's the biggest thing stepping into 2020.
I get that. From an individual standpoint, I think that's so big. I want to stress that you suffered that ACL tear. It's the kind of injury that could derail a career. You have to rebuild yourself physically to be sure. Do you have to rebuild yourself emotionally and kind of rebuild your mindset? Do you have to reinvent yourself? How do you approach that when you have an injury like that?
Yeah, you know, that was one of the toughest parts. You know, like you say, I mean, you have to rebuild yourself mentally, emotionally, and everything. You know, it's something for me that really taught me a lot through the ACL injury was patience. You know, I think that was a big thing for myself, you know, wanting to wake up every day and feel like I felt the day before I got injured, you know, wanting to be back to the normal standpoint of where I was at, you know. But again, I mean, just for me to kind of preach to myself then patience, and also just the fact that, you know, a lot of guys say when they step onto the field and things like that, that, you know, that they're a hard worker, you know, that they have a passion for the game. You know, everything that you say will one day be tested. And, you know, for me, it was tested through that injury. You know, my passion for, you know, me getting myself back out there, you know, facing adversity, you know, my work ethic, you know, being able to have patience and things like that. You know, everything was tested, you know, and I think that for me, you know, for my own career, you know, I think I'm very grateful, you know, for suffering that, because I think it took me to a standpoint mentally that I don't know if I would be at, you know, right now if I didn't have that injury. You know, I think it challenged me in a lot of different ways that I hadn't been challenged before.
I mean, so would you change anything? Like, obviously, you don't want to go through something like that, but if you could do it all again, are you better for having gone through it, or would you have been much better having not gone through it?
You know, I think the easy road would say, you know, better having not gone through it, you know, but I don't think that, you know. I think that I'm better having gone through that. Like I said before, I think it taught me a lot of different things and also landed me into the place that I am now. You know, I love playing in Chicago. You know, I've had fun playing here in Chicago. You know, my first year I got here, you know, helped lead a team to the playoffs. It was my first time actually playing in the playoffs. You know, so it's put me in a very good position, you know, even to the standpoint of, you know, playing in Chicago. And this is the most of my parents have been able to come and see me play, you know, being from Detroit, you know, it's a quick drive, you know. So it's a lot of different things that have led me to the point that I'm at right now, you know, and I think that that's one of them.
And listen, it's long been said, I believe this, if you're a star athlete in Chicago, man, you're made. I mean, you're a made man for a long, long time, forever. And you've only been there two seasons, but given how young you are, and it's kind of hard to believe, Alan, you're still just 26 and you're 6 years in, but after only 2 years, there's already talk about you making a run at the all-time Bears receiving list. So what's your reaction when you hear that? And to this point, how much fun are you having playing in Chicago?
You know, I'm having a lot of fun. You know, again, I think that for me, this has been the most fun that I've had in my career. You know, playing for Coach Nagy, you know, has been awesome. You know, he's a coach that you want to play for. Each and every day you come to work, you know, he's a guy that, you know, is almost like a player himself. You know, I mean, we're all trying to accomplish one thing together. You know, so it's been fun. And also, you know, hearing the all-time leading receiver for the Bears, you know, I think that's special too. You know, when you think about the Bears tradition and how long they've been around, you know, to be able to, at the end of the day, at the end of my career, possibly to say that, you know, that's me at the all-time leading spot, you know, for the Bears being around for 100 years, you know, I think that speaks to itself. You know, that's definitely a special accomplishment. You know, you don't see things like that coming around too often.
So before I let you go, you mentioned that the team obviously did not finish the year the way it had hoped. It's no secret the offense was not as explosive last season as everybody had hoped for and expected, and the results were not what were expected. When you think about last season, how do you as an offense go about learning from that, growing from that, and then getting back to where you think you should be?
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest thing for us is just learning where we didn't have success at, you know, and that's a lot of different things, you know. But from an overall team perspective, I will say this, you know, I think for us, you know, again, finishing 8-8, we didn't accomplish what we wanted to accomplish. You know, I think we lost two games in the division, both to the same team, you know, but other than that, we won our division games. We had a ton of injuries. You know, I think that for us, it spoke to a lot to the coaching, to the culture that we have, and to our players. You know, I think when you have the injuries that we had and kind of suffered that and have some of the things that we have going on, you know, you see a lot of teams go through the adversity that we went through and they go 3-13. Those teams go 5-11. For us, up until week 15, we were right on the cusp to possibly make the playoffs, you know. So I think that says a lot about, you know, just the kind of culture that we have, you know. So for us, I don't think we're far off from where we need to be at all, you know, from a team standpoint or offensively. You know, I think it's just some things that we need to lock into a little bit this offseason, you know, become better at some things as far as executing wise, you know, seeing everything through the same set of eyes. But, you know, wholeheartedly, I feel like we're right there. You know, I don't think we're far off at all from where we were a couple years ago when we made it to the playoffs.
Jerome,
Brother, welcome back. How you been?
Oh, Vance Mack, thanks again. I tell you, I am absolutely honored and feel very special in the jungle to be asked to call back. I don't really have a serious take on anything. I just wanted to know, with all this baking and drinking, those two thoughts I had earlier, probably all I could hold on to today. But anyway, love your show. And even when we go back out of this thing, if we ever do, I'll still be around. And you know what? I would not like just one golden ticket if I can have them all. I would like all the golden tickets. I'm out, Rome.
Broham, let's not get greedy. No, I cannot give you all the golden tickets. But damn if I won't give you one.
Because I've got a golden ticket. I've got a golden ticket.
Antoine Winfield Jr. is my guest. Antoine, great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Good, good. Good to visit with you. In fact, let me ask you, how are you and your family doing in the middle of this pandemic, and what's it been like for you?
Yeah, right now we're just, you know, practicing social distancing at home. For me, it's just been a lot of just staying at home and then just doing workouts here. That's pretty much all I've been doing.
Yeah, so it's so unusual in the sense that you're getting ready for the draft and you spent your entire life getting to this moment. So what's it been like meeting with teams via FaceTime and trying to stay in shape during this time?
Yeah, you know, it's a different experience. We're not able to meet face-to-face right now, so it's been a lot of FaceTime calls and phone calls, so that's been different. But workouts have been good. I have a gym at home. I'm able to lift here, and there's a field like a mile away where I'm able to do all my football work and everything. So it's been a unique experience.
We're talking to Antoine Winfield Jr. to be sure for everybody. Now, you're coming off a year where you led the team in tackles. You tied for the school record for INTs. You led the team to 11 wins. Considering where this program was not that long ago, how special was last season for you and for the team overall?
Yeah, it was very special. You know, we had a great year. It was very exciting. We did things that Minnesota football has never done, or they haven't done it in 115 years. So it was just great to just be a part of that.
You know, there's so many amazing moments from last season that we could talk about, but let's go to that Penn State game. You guys were undefeated. You were playing at home. Number 4 Penn State was coming to town. You had 2 interceptions in that win over the Nittany Lions in front of a sold-out stadium. I mean, you've had a lot of really good games and a lot of good moments, but what do you remember most about that afternoon?
Yeah, I just remember all the fans storming the field after the game. That was probably – I'll remember that for the rest of my life. Right when the game was over, just everybody came onto the field, and it was ridiculous. But it was an awesome day that day.
Now, you had faced some challenges as it relates to injuries, and the team had gone through some pretty challenging times as well. So what did it feel like to have all that hard work pay off the way it did and for you and the team to come through the way it did, given all that sacrifice?
Yeah, it felt amazing. Like, I was hurt the 2 years previous, and so it just felt good to just be able to be healthy throughout the entire season and just to be able to play with the team this past year, and we just had a great time out there.
You know what it is, especially given who your father was and you grew up with it. You always hear that availability is your best ability. A lot of this is beyond your control.
For sure.
Man, it's a violent sport, so a lot of it's luck, and a lot of it's beyond your control. But how much of that season was about you coming in with a certain mindset, like, I'm not coming off the field. I'll do whatever I have to do to stay on the field and make sure that they know what I'm about?
Yeah, that was my number one priority, stay on the field. Stay healthy throughout the entire season, because as long as I stayed healthy, I knew I was going to go out there and ball. So that was just my main focus, was just to stay healthy and get out on the field and just give it all that I had.
Antoine Winfield Jr. getting ready for the upcoming NFL draft. Now, I've had PJ Fleck on this show for years now, going all the way back to his early days in Western Michigan. Now, he's a different dude, and I mean that in the best way possible, a different dude in terms of energy and language. What was it like the first time you met him?
Yeah, the first time I met him, I'm like, who is this guy? You know, he has so much energy and so much passion, and being with him the last 3 years, he was like that every time I seen him. It's not fake. That's really who he is. And one thing I like about him is just how he treats his players. He's so passionate about his job and what he does. And he's just a great overall person and coach.
Now, before the 2018 season, he asked you if you'd be up for returning punts, something you had done in high school, but you had not done it yet in college. And to work on that, you kind of, well, you worked on it, you freshened up your skills. And then in the second quarter of the season opener against New Mexico State, you took a number of hits, you broke a number of tackles, and then you break off this amazing return of 76 yards for a TD. I mean, it's an amazing play. What do you remember about that play?
Yeah, I just remember that was my actual first punt return, and I just remember I wanted to score. And so I'm like, nothing's going to take me down. I'm going to score this first one. You know, practice it throughout all fall camp and spring ball. And I just remember getting my one-shot opportunity, and I just took advantage of it and made a big play.
I can't stress this enough. It was more than a big play. It was an amazing play, that you got that thing to the house. Now, PJ and I talked about you in the past and what you mean to the program. I ran down the list of accomplishments at the start of the interview, but what's it mean to you to know that you've left your mark on that particular program at Minnesota? What's that feel like?
It means everything. You know, I came in to University of Minnesota expecting big things. And as you read off the list, I was just like, wow, I went over there and did all that. And, you know, I'm just proud of everything that I've been through and all the accomplishments that I acquired at my time in Minnesota.
Antoine Winfield Jr. is my guest for a few more moments. And now you're looking ahead. Earlier this month, Ryan Clark was on Twitter. He posted his analysis after watching some film on you. He was definitely hyping you up. Another guy that I have immense respect for, Tyrann Mathieu, replied, quote, "Somebody gonna overthink it. He will be a two-time All-Pro by the time he's 30. I see that when I watch him. He's smart, go to sleep, and think about the plays he's gonna make. I hope we get him," end quote. I mean, dude, that is incredibly high praise from an incredibly well-respected player. What do you think when you see that and hear that from Tyrann Mathieu?
Yeah, you know, it's just good to be recognized. He's one of those guys that I remember watching his highlights when I was growing up and seeing what type of player he was. And that's kind of why I wanted to emulate my game like him, because he was a dog out on the field. And it's just great to be recognized by players like that. And, you know, I still got to put a lot of work in, but it's just good to be recognized in that sense.
You know, it seems like one of the things that they really like about you and your game is the physicality that you bring to it. It seems like you really love to hit and you really love to tackle. Where does that passion and that physicality come from?
I think just growing up and playing the game. I've always been like that type of player that's physical, that's trying to make tackles. And I feel like just growing up that way, I've always been like that.
All right, so I waited till the very end to ask you about your dad, Antoine Winfield Sr. I used to talk to him when he played. This is a great, great player. What was it like growing up the son of a legendary football player?
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, back when I was younger, I didn't really think about it too much. I'm like, that's just my dad. But as I got older, I realized, like, wow, he really played in the NFL for 14 years. I'm like, how did he do it? I'm still trying to figure out how he did it. But growing up, it was great. You know, he always gave me advice on pretty much everything that I needed as far as football. And it was great just to have that, because it was definitely an advantage that I used when I was younger. You know, at a young age, he had me in the backyard doing footwork drills, cone drills, working on my back pedal, watching film, all these great things at a young age, which ultimately you could see it paid off at the end of the day.
Well, see, now you know what it takes. So to answer your question, how did he do it? How did he play that long at that high level?
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure it out myself. But, you know, it was just hard work. Hard work all the time. Every time after he'd get home from practice of the game, he was in his room studying, taking care of his body, stretching at night, doing push-ups and sit-ups, and doing all these things outside of football. So I think that's one way I can see how he did it.
How about this? There's a story about how when you were a kid, you were sitting with him when he was breaking down film as he got ready to face Calvin Johnson. What was that like, and what did you learn from those film sessions?
Yeah, it was just cool to see how he broke it down. So I remember he was just in his bed watching film on his little DVD player. And I came in there and I was just watching with him. And he was just watching how he was releasing off of the press. And I remember that specifically. And he was just going through Calvin Johnson's film and just breaking it down pretty much. And so it was a cool experience.
Let me ask you something. Like I mentioned off the very top when I ran down your list of accomplishments, a lot of that was academic. You were a three-time academic All-Big Ten player, a Big Ten Distinguished Scholar. I mean, I guess I could make the argument that if you were to focus entirely on football and do just enough to get by in the classroom, you'd be set to go to the NFL. But that clearly was not the case. Why did you go as hard as you did in the classroom?
Oh, you have to go hard in the classroom. You know, academics was my first priority. You know, how you do anything is how you do everything. So how I emulated my game on the field, I did that in the classroom as well. So it wasn't those things that where I could just slack off. You know, I tried to be my best in both areas.
What a great line that is. How you do anything is how you do everything. Who taught you that?
Yeah, I got that, I believe, from Coach Fleck, actually.
I'm not surprised to hear that. I'm not surprised to hear that. The NFL draft is coming up on Thursday. A Big Ten Distinguished Scholar, a unanimous All-American, and a Big Ten Defensive Back of the Year. Antoine, as I mentioned, I want to run you down before the draft. I appreciate you making time. Good luck on the draft, Dan. I'll look forward to seeing where you end up.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Good night now!